The reading of Holy Scripture tonight comes from Psalm 49. Psalm 49. This will be the basis for the exposition of Lord's Day 5 of the Heidelberg Catechism this evening. Lord's Day 5 begins the second section of the Catechism on man's deliverance. Psalm 49, "Hear this, all ye people, give ear, all ye inhabitants of the world, both low and high, rich and poor together. My mouth shall speak of wisdom, and the meditation of my heart shall be of understanding. I will incline mine ear to a parable. I will open my dark saying upon the harp. Wherefore should I fear in the days of evil, when the iniquity of my heels," and better that would be "the iniquity at my heels, when the iniquity at my heels shall compass me about. They that trust in their wealth and boast themselves in the multitude of their riches, none of them can by any means redeem his brother, nor give to God a ransom for him. For the redemption of their soul is precious, and it ceaseth forever, that he should still live forever and not see corruption. For he seeth that wise men die, likewise the fool and the brutish person perish, and leave their wealth to others. Their inward thought is that their houses shall continue forever, and their dwelling places to all generations. They call their lands after their own names. Nevertheless, man being in honor abideth not. He is like the beasts that perish. This their way is their folly. Yet their posterity approve their sayings. Like sheep they are laid in the grave. Death shall feed on them, and the upright shall have dominion over them in the morning. And their beauty shall consume in the grave from their dwelling. But God will redeem my soul from the power of the grave, for he shall receive me. Be not thou afraid when one is made rich, when the glory of his house is increased. For when he dieth, he shall carry nothing away. His glory shall not descend after him. Though while he lived, he blessed his soul, and men will praise thee when thou doest well to thyself, he shall go to the generations of his fathers. They shall never see light. Man that is in honor and understandeth not is like the beasts that perish." On the basis of Psalm 49, many other passages throughout the Old and New Testaments, the Heidelberg Catechism explains to us the only way of redemption. Lord's Day 5. The Catechism has taken us through the section on our sin and depravity, showed us that, and also showed us the punishment that is justly due to us for it, so that we cry out in Lord's Day 5, "Since then, by the righteous judgment of God, we deserve temporal and eternal punishment. Is there no way by which we may escape that punishment and be again received into favor?" And our teacher answers us, "God will have his justice satisfied. And therefore we must make this full satisfaction either by ourselves or by another." Can we ourselves then make this satisfaction? By no means. But on the contrary, we daily increase our debt. Can there be found anywhere one who is a mere creature able to satisfy for us? None. For first, God will not punish any other creature for the sin which man hath committed. And further, no mere creature can sustain the burden of God's eternal wrath against sin so as to deliver others from it. What sort of a mediator and deliverer then must we seek for? For one who is very man and perfectly righteous and yet more powerful than all creatures. That is, one who is also very God. Let's read the first two question and answers of Lord's Day 6 tonight as well. Why must he be very man and also perfectly righteous? Because the justice of God requires that the same human nature which hath sinned should likewise make satisfaction for sin, and one who is himself a sinner cannot satisfy for others. Why must he in one person be also very God? That he might, by the power of his Godhead, sustain in his human nature the burden of God's wrath, and might obtain for and restore to us righteousness and life. Beloved of God, Psalm 49, which we read this evening, is a unique psalm. It's unique among the psalms for two reasons. First of all, Psalm 49 is one of the only, if not the only, psalm where the psalmist himself, in the writing of this psalm, reveals to us that he knows he's being inspired by God as he is writing it. Verses 3 and 4 of Psalm 49, "My mouth shall speak of wisdom, and the meditation of my heart shall be of understanding. I will incline mine ear to a parable. I will open my dark saying upon the harp." The psalmist tells us, I'm going to now incline mine ear to a parable. Not I'm going to incline my mouth to a parable, but my ear. In other words, he's telling us, God is going to give me something to say, and I'm going to listen to what God has to say, and then I will write it down in song upon my harp. The psalmist was aware that he was getting his inspired words from God himself. Second, Psalm 49 is unique among the psalms because it has more to say about the wicked rich than any other psalm in the Psalter. The psalm is filled with references to wealth and to the foolishness of those who trust in that wealth. Putting those two things that are unique about this psalm together, Psalm 49 then is the inspired words of God concerning riches. What they can do and what they cannot do, how deceiving they can be and how many are deceived by them, and how foolish they manifest the wicked who trust in them to be, and how much better it is to have the heavenly spiritual gifts of God in our lives. That makes Psalm 49 a psalm that is full of wisdom. The psalmist knows that too. Verse 3, "My mouth shall speak of wisdom." Wisdom with respect to riches, and wisdom with respect to redemption, and wisdom with respect to the connection or lack thereof between riches and redemption. Redemption, that the psalmist tells us, comes from God, not from the wealth or honor that a person attains in this life. Because this psalm supplies for us that wisdom, wisdom regarding something so important as redemption, wisdom in an area where there is so much foolishness in this world and vain trust in riches, the psalmist is aware that this is vitally important, that he must give this witness of wisdom to all who will hear in all the world. Hear this, all ye people, he says at the beginning. Give ear, all ye inhabitants of the world, both low and high, rich and poor together. My mouth shall speak of wisdom. All in the world should hear, ought to hear, this message the psalmist brings about wisdom in regard to redemption and in regard to riches, and where redemption and riches do not intersect. Lord's Day 5 of the Heidelberg Catechism helps the psalmist to get his message out. Lord's Day 5 is also about where deliverance can and cannot come from, and what riches cannot do. In fact, if you look at the texts in the margins, Lord's Day 5, specifically next to question and answer 14, you will see Psalm 49, verses 8 and 9 listed there. Lord's Day 5 is a reflection of the teaching of Psalm 49. It issues forth the same wisdom, knowing where redemption can and cannot come from. As we examine Lord's Day 5 this evening, we start, as I said, the second section of the Heidelberg Catechism on man's deliverance. In the first section, the Catechism has held the law before us so that we can see our sin. And it has driven us to not only see our sin, but the curse of God due to us for it justly, the just punishment of God that would be ours for that sin. In Lord's Day 4, the Catechism went on to predict, very rightly, all the ways we would try to excuse ourselves for the guilt of our own sin and try to make light of the fact that we deserve the punishment of God for that sin. The Catechism has, through this first section, then carefully led us to not just know ourselves as sinners, but to see it in our own lives and to be confronted with what that means, to face that reality. And as it has closed the door to any excuse we have had, any way to get out of facing the real truth that we are sinners that deserve the just judgment of God, now the Catechism assumes that a question rises out of the depths of our soul at the head of Lord's Day 5. Since all our attempts to escape this reality, to convince ourselves that there is nothing wrong here, that we don't have to worry, that there is no punishment for sin, since all those attempts have failed, we've been forced to face it, and now it's been pressed out of us, this question: is there any way to escape this then? Is there any way to get out of this? That I deserve hell for my rebellions against the God who fashioned me? And the answer comes, yes. Yes, there is. There's a way. But only wisdom will be able to see it. And the folly of the world that is deceived by the glitter of riches and wealth is blinded, can't see it. Only those enlightened by the Spirit, whether they are poor or rich in their own selves, will see God alone saves. Riches and redemption. Let's notice first from the psalm, riches can't redeem. Second, the way of satisfaction. And third, the comfort for the wise. Riches and redemption. Riches can't redeem, the way of satisfaction, and the comfort for the wise. Psalm 49 is about the wealthy. But it has a certain kind of wealthy in mind. It'd be the section of society that we might call the super rich. Though from one point of view, you and I are wealthy. We compare ourselves to the standards of the majority of the world. The text has in mind people with an obscene amount of wealth. It has in mind the top 3% or so. Verse 6 speaks of the multitude or the abundance of these people's riches. Heaps is the idea. Abundances of money and possessions, so that they hardly know what to do with it all and hardly know what to do with themselves now that they have it all. Verse 16 speaks of the glory of their houses. They make to themselves these mansions, these sprawling homes, and then TV shows come in to tape their homes to show you how they have everything you could ever imagine in their homes. They can get lost in these homes. They have sometimes many of them. Verse 11 speaks of their dwelling places, plural, homes here and there. They have lands, verse 11, properties that they own that are passed down to their succeeding generations. Verse 11, their inward thought is that their houses shall continue forever, their dwelling places to all generations. They call their lands after their own names. The wealthy that the text has in mind then are the sports stars of the age, the TV and movie stars, the business gurus, the pop culture stars, the political rulers, and all the rest with their abundance of wealth and possessions. It has in mind the people whom society elevates over other people precisely because of their great wealth and their worldly success. Verse 2 calls them high in society as opposed to low. On the social ladder as well as on the financial ladder, these are the people at the top, on the top rung. And all the rest of the people in society look up to them, think that these people are above them and above everybody else. It's the people that other people want to read about in the magazines. They want to watch them talk on the late night talk shows and hear them talk about their vacation, even though they wouldn't care at all 2 cents about anybody else's vacation. It's people that they want to dress like, they want to look like. They envy them, they want to be like them, they want to have their life. And nothing prevents that adulation of these people at the top of the social ladder. All of the drugs and all the divorce and all the pain and the suicide rate that is through the roof for that strata of society doesn't stop people from envying them and wanting to be them. They're the high in society. No matter what foolish things they do or how they make fools of themselves, they're still held in high honor among men. Verse 12 says that these men are in honor. Their wealth and their success brings them a certain weight in society. They seem to matter more than other people in a land. The rules don't seem to apply to them like they apply to others. Their lives are seen as more valuable than other lives. They're in a section of society that seems to be above the law. When one of them dies, the whole world stops and takes notice. Whereas no one reacts that way when somebody without that wealth and worldly success passes away. When they speak in arrogance about themselves and about what they do. Whereas if somebody else spoke that way, society would find it disgusting and reprehensible. With them, they honor them even more for it. Verse 11 says that they call their lands after their own names. They're all about the exaltation of themselves. They put their name all over everything that they own. Their hotels, their towers, their charitable organizations to glorify themselves in their own names. Verse 6 says they boast themselves in the multitude of their riches. Without shame, they talk about how great they believe they are. Verse 18 says that they bless their own souls and do well to themselves. They do things to magnify their own selves. They get together with others who are in that strata of society. And they have awards that they give to each other. And then everybody watches it on TV as they honor one another in their sheer arrogance. And yet still, everyone holds them in high esteem and honor. In fact, the more they do it, the more people fawn all over them. Verse 18 says that while he lived, he blessed his own soul, and men will praise thee for it when thou doest well to thyself. But these riches, and this wealth, and this adulation of men, more often than not, blinds the wicked rich to the recognition of their own insignificance and their own humanity and their own standing before the God who created them. In fact, except God's Spirit regenerate always, the wealth and the adulation has that effect. And that regeneration in God's sovereignty doesn't happen that often. Not many mighty, the apostle said to the Corinthians, not many mighty, not many noble, not many wealthy are called, but God has chosen the base things of this world to confound the wise. God lets them be blinded by the wealth and the adulation of the masses, so that in their pride, stubbornness, they're blinded to their own mortality. Psalm 49 makes that clear. They're blinded to their own humanness. Verse 20, man that is in honor understandeth not, is like the beast that perish. He perishes no different from anybody else and no different from any living creature, a beast in the field, but he doesn't understand it about himself. He knows it theoretically, but he can't face it and he can't live in the recognition of it. He lives in such a way that he thinks he's superhuman. He thinks that he'll live forever by his riches and wealth and station. He's able to do a lot of things, and by doing those things with that wealth, he convinces himself that he's not like the rest, that he's not going to die like the rest die. By his wealth, he's able to rise above the majority of things that come to a regular man in his life and remind him of his humanity, of his mortality. He's able to buy the best doctors and best medical care, able with the wealth and position to secure a place in society that is of the most ease. They're able to ride above the majority of the storms of life. That's part of the reason why people envy them. They think, though most of them would not admit it, that the wealth makes them superhuman. Because they rise above the judgments of men, somehow they're able to rise above the judgment of God. And they can't really live in the reality of the fact that one day they die, stand before their Maker, who will not let them rise above His law. And if something does happen that breaks through their world to make them recognize their humanity for a moment, they turn to their wealth, trust in their riches, get them through it. Investing thousands, millions of dollars in the attempt to stay young, youthful looking. Investing thousands, millions of dollars in the hope even of coming back to life on this earth again if they do die. If you don't believe that, then you aren't paying attention. Many of them, are now paying companies to cryogenically freeze their bodies in the hope that in the future, science will discover how to make us live forever. And then those scientists will be able to unfreeze their bodies, bring them back to life, and make them live forever. Look up when you get home, cryonics.org. You will find this quote on the front page, quote, life is priceless. Imagine a world free of disease, death, and aging. At the Cryonics Institute, we believe that day is inevitably coming, and cryonics is presently our best chance of getting there. Our mission is to extend human lifespans by preserving the body using existing cryogenic technologies with the goal of future revival by future science, end quote. Eventually, man will evolve to a point where he's eliminated all disease and all death itself. He'll create a utopia on this earth in which man will live forever by his ingenuity. Apart from God, he will usher in heaven by his own wisdom. And the only way to be a part of that kingdom now that's in the future yet is to freeze your body for millions of dollars and then be resurrected by your fellow men someday in the future. It's an anti-Christian hope. It's an anti-Christian heaven. It's an anti-Christian replacement for the resurrection. Some of them are just freezing their brains in the hope that they will be put in better bodies one day in the future when science brings them back to life. Don't think, beloved, that these ideas in their root have not always been there. In the collective conscience of men, this has not always been the idea and the goal. Verse 9 of Psalm 49 speaks of this very thing. They think they'll be able to live forever and not see corruption and escape by their wealth, by their buying ability, the judgment of God. Verse 11 adds, their inward thought is that their houses shall continue forever, their dwelling places to all generations. They think they can live forever. Their money will be able to buy a way of escaping God's judgment, by a way of escaping that confrontation with their Maker. And if not that, then many of them think that if they do have to face it, their money will get them through it, will buy their way past the judgment of God. And of course, the Romish church is more than happy to feed that blindness to its own advantage. Verse 7 says that they think they can give to God a ransom for their soul or for the soul of their brother. Look up sometime Rome's doctrine of partial and plenary indulgences. Or by the giving of money, that church teaches people they can buy their way out of the punishment of God. And wealthy, wealthy people all over this globe give exorbitant amounts of money to the Roman church, thinking that they're buying their soul's ransom or the ransom of the soul of their loved one. Just as verse 7 says, if they pay for enough masses to be said, they can buy off God and merit life in heaven. But of course, it's not only Rome. Protestant churches can at times further the blindness of the wicked rich to the same notion. When they won't enact church discipline on the member who leaves his wife for someone he's more in love with, because after all, that one gives a lot of money in the collection plate. And they're telling that man, your wealth has made you okay before God and before us. Your wealth has given you a pass. It redeems you from your sin. But it doesn't work. Verse 7 of Psalm 49, none of them can by any means redeem his brother nor give to God a ransom for him. They try, but they can't. You can't give to God your wealth for a ransom for your soul. Why not? Verse 8, for the redemption of the soul is precious and it ceaseth forever. That means the redemption of a soul is costly. It's a precious amount is the idea, an amount that nobody can attain to. The cost is beyond what anybody can reach. And therefore, the money that they think they are using to redeem their soul will cease forever. It does no good. It stops. It ends. The redemption of the soul is precious. It's costly. The payment for the soul can't be made with any amount of money, no matter how much it is. You could do a lot of things with money. You can buy a lot of things. You can buy ease in this life. You can smooth things out in your life for a time. But it cannot buy you a pass through the judgment of God and eternal life. No matter how much you pay to cryogenically freeze your body or how much you give to the church on earth, it cannot redeem your soul from destruction before a holy God. It can't be done. Because that precious cost is hell. That's how costly it is to redeem a soul. God requires the bearing of eternal hell for the sins one has committed in their soul in this life. we cry at the head of Lord's Day 5. Is there a way out? Is there a way of escape? Is there a way of redemption for my soul from the punishment that I was forced to see and face in Lord's Day 4? A payment that can be made to grant me eternal life. A payment that can be made to redeem me, to release me from the obligation to bear that just punishment for sin that I had to face in Lord's Day 4. And the answer is yes, there is. There is a way. There is a payment that can be made, but it must be a payment that satisfies the justice of God. It can't get around the justice of God. And the justice of God can't but require what sin deserves. And sin deserves temporal and eternal punishment, we learned in Lord's Day 4. It deserves hell. God simply can't let a man go for his sin and dismiss the punishment and say, oh, well, he's just. Just like a judge can't just dismiss the punishment. He's just. The punishment must be taken. It must be meted out and it must be borne. Therefore, the cost for a redemption of a soul is the bearing of an eternity in hell. It's costly. The redemption of the soul is precious. It's costly. There's two options. Either one has to satisfy the punishment of hell that justice requires for that sin himself, or somebody else has to agree and be able to do it for you. But not only that, that punishment of an eternity in hell must be borne willingly. God's law, given to us rightly in the beginning, was that His creatures that He made, that He fashioned from the dust, that He put His own image upon in the beginning, love Him with all their heart, mind, soul, and strength all the time. The requirement, therefore, the payment for a soul is that that eternity in hell be borne, while at the same time as one is bearing that punishment, they're loving this God who's punishing them with all their heart, mind, soul, and strength. Otherwise, there's constantly more sin to be punished and it never ends. This is why, part of the reason why it never ends, hell for the wicked. One must bear it in love for the Father as their sole motive, every second of it. That's bearing the wrath of God. That's bearing the punishment and making the payment willingly. There's a difference between bearing and enduring. The wicked endure that wrath of God in hell, but they never bear it. They endure it, never willingly taking it upon themselves in love for Father. But to make a payment, one must bear it, take it upon oneself, and drink the cup to its end all the while, and the soul crying out, Father, even though I'm forsaken, I still love Thee. The redemption of the soul is precious, it's costly. There's no way around this. This is the only payment. And without that payment, no matter how much money the wicked rich have, they die as anybody else who's outside of Christ dies. Verse 12, He's like the beast that perish. Verse 14, like sheep they're laid in a grave. Death shall feed on them. For all eternity, death feeds on them. Verse 14, their beauty shall consume in the grave from their dwelling. Verse 17, when he dieth, he shall carry nothing away. His glory shall not descend after him. Verse 19, he shall go to the generation of his fathers. They shall never see light. Do you really envy them? Really? You want to be like them? You want to have their life? Young people? You're really fascinated with what they do? What Allow them to be an influence upon your life and the decisions that you make. Really? You want to dress like them? You want to listen to their music? Really? They spew forth their folly? Apart from Christ, they're blinded by their wealth and their folly and in their pride. They're the most unenviable people in the world, with no wisdom from God. Fools bound by their own folly. The smallest child here who understands the gospel is wiser than they are. You are wiser than they are, aren't you, people of God? You see reality, do you not? You live in reality, do you not? You fully face the fact that you're going to die one day and stand before the judge of all the earth, who gave you every breath that you've ever taken. And you face the reality, haven't you, that God's justice requires payment for sin, and that the redemption of the soul is costly, that costly, and that the cost is not only one that the wicked rich can't make by their wealth or whatever they attain with their wealth, but is one that can't be made by anybody with anything that they have. That you can't make this payment by anything that you have. Or by anything you don't have. Just as wealth can't make the payment, neither can a lack of wealth. Just as being in a high position can't pay the costly payment for a soul, neither can the fact that you're in a low position. As though you can look up to them and say, all the things I've had to endure in this life while those people live a high life, that just shows that I deserve something better in the next life coming. As though what you endure in this life while all those rich people are coasting along is a payment, though you'd never say it, a payment that you can hand to God. I had to suffer this and this and those people were off in their yachts and all that. I deserve to go to heaven after all of what I've been through. The answer of the text and of the catechism is not, beloved, that the rich man can't buy the redemption of his soul by his riches, but the poor man can by virtue of his poverty and his struggle and his suffering. That there's something inherently better about being not rich. That the lack of riches and struggle is in itself an offering to God to atone for my sin. Yeah, I did that and that, Lord, but look what I had to go through. That surely pays for what I did there. The rich are blinded to facing the reality of the payment that is necessary for the soul. But the not rich man can be just as blinded. Or this, if I can't make a payment to God to earn my way into heaven by the struggles I've had to go through, surely I can by being a decent person. I have good values. That will do it. I'm a moral guy compared to a lot of people. And I have good Midwestern values. Well, all those big city people are living the high life over there. That surely has got to say something. I could give that to God. And you're doing the same thing that the rich man is tempted to do. At the end of the day, it's just a different attempt to buy God off, isn't it? It's the American religion. Be a decent enough person. Have your good outweigh your bad. And that's what God requires. That's the payment. To satisfy His justice for your soul. Are you wise, beloved? Wisdom in Psalm 49 is to see oneself poor, not merely with respect to money and the wealth of this world, but poor with respect to one's own sin and one's own inability to do anything in himself to satisfy the justice of God. Wisdom is the realization that as a poor sinner, I can never give God what is owed. I only daily increase my debt. I don't love Him with all my heart, soul, and strength. And I'm not going to tomorrow, and even if I did, I couldn't endure eternal hell and love for Him. I only add more to my sin and increase the debt that I have to pay. Catechism uses an illustration from the financial world here, doesn't it? One that all of us can easily understand, especially if we have ourselves been through difficult times financially where we struggle and maybe daily increase our debt. Can't maintain our own household budget and every expense that goes on the credit card just increases the debt, even if it's not superfluous, but the necessities of life, you buy it, it increases the debt. That's a burden. That's a struggle, and those are tough times. My beloved, if we think that that is a burden, this burden that that one illustrates is so much greater. That one you can still pay off, but not this one. Every day we increase our debt of sin and cannot pay the eternity in hell for the sins that we commit. I can't even love Him perfectly now, much less as I'm enduring an eternal wrath and hellish agony. Catechism means for us to see what the text would also have us to see here tonight. The redemption of the soul is precious, it's costly. No one can pay it. No one. That's why even though Psalm 49 is all about wealth, it's addressed not just to the rich, but to everyone. Hear this, all ye people. Give ear, all ye inhabitants of the world, both low and high, both rich and poor together. None of them can by any means redeem his brother, nor give to God a ransom for him. For the redemption of their soul is precious. The catechism and the text together are shutting us up to any way of self-payment, of self-escape. It wants us to despair of self. There is a way of escape. Yes, there is a payment that can be made, but you can't pay it, and I can't. It's an impossible payment to be made. No one can make it. Nobody you can find can make it. An angel can't make this payment for me. Angels are sinless. They can love God perfectly. Maybe they could bear this punishment and pay the cost. But this payment can't be made by any other being than a real human being. For the justice of God demands that man must pay for man's sins. We're stuck. Do you see? It's led us to cry out, is there any way of escape out of our desperation? And then briefly for a moment it said, yes, yes there is. But now the catechism crushes all of our hopes again by saying, but it's a payment that you can't make. And it's a payment that nobody can make. And we're supposed to, right here at this point, cry out, well, fine answer then. There's a way of escape or payment that could theoretically be made for my soul, but it's impossible. This is the section on deliverance. We just started deliverance. I had my hopes up. But now you're telling me the only way of deliverance is an impossibility. Who can make this payment? It's too precious. It's too costly. And it wants us to cry out that redemption of a soul is so costly that the only one who could possibly pay it is if a being exists theoretically that was fully human, fully God, and perfectly righteous all at the same time. And where are we going to get one of those? A being that's fully human and that therefore can represent us as man, that's fully God and could bear an eternal wrath and love at the same time, and perfectly righteous and therefore has no sins for himself to pay for. Well, the only way is if God himself would be willing to somehow come down here and make that payment himself, robe himself in human flesh. And you see, now the Catechism has us where it wants us. In Psalm 49:2, for Psalm 49 is driving to verse 15, but God will redeem my soul from the power of the grave. He's the only way out. He's the only way of escape. The price of a soul is so great that only God himself can pay it. But God is the one who is demanding the payment. The one to whom I owe this payment is the only one who can make the payment. Would he be willing to pay this for me? And if he would, why would he? It's right there. My Lord's Day 5 leaves us with that question. That thought. That's where it stops until next time. But thankfully for us tonight, that's not where the text stops. The text lets us skip ahead a little bit. And it answers us by saying, that God to whom the payment is owed is so full of deep and unending love for the very people who have rebelled against him, that for them, he will do it. He will come down himself, and he will make the payment. For he is not only just, he is also merciful. And for his people, he's willing. But God will redeem my soul from the power of the grave, the psalmist cries out. For he shall receive me. He shall receive me. He shall bring me back to himself in love. That's the comfort here in the text. And isn't that really what we were crying out about at the head of Lord's Day 5 in the first place? The question at the head of Lord's Day 5 was not just this. Is there no way by which we may escape that punishment, period? It's this. Is there no way by which we may escape that punishment and again positively be received back into His favor? Escape that negatively, but positively again be brought back into the fellowship and love that Adam had with Him before the fall. And better, again able to walk and talk with Him in the cool of the night, to bask in the presence of His love and fellowship, to speak with Him and commune with Him in the warmth of His favor. The psalmist knows that it's possible, and not only possible, but that He will. He will. He shall receive me. I may know that. Not only the psalmist may know that, you may know that by faith, as Lord's Day 7 we'll get to. I may know that the payment has been made for me, that He comes in His love to bear the requirements of His own justice away, to pay hell on my behalf. Knowing that, beloved, I don't have to fear the afterlife. I don't have to turn into a fool and turn to desperate measures like trying to freeze my body to come back again later, or to buy my way out of God's judgment by my giving. No fear in death, for He is willing. The only one who could do it is willing to come down and to make the payment for me. I'm not afraid. Because if He does that, then He loves me. And I don't have to fear whatever He gives me in this current life either. Whether I'm rich or poor. Verse 5 of Psalm 49, "Wherefore should I fear in the days of evil, when the iniquity at my heels shall compass me about?" When the days of evil are upon me in this life, when the iniquity, some has in mind here, the iniquity of the wicked rich nipping at the heels of the people of God. "Wherefore should I fear?" He says, I don't have to fear. God has granted wisdom. I know that I shall not be left forgotten in the grave, but from corruption Thou, O Lord, Thy Holy One wilt save. By His enlightening grace I see that only He could pay the precious cost for the soul, and that He has done it for me. I've not been deceived by riches. I'm safe. I'm secure in Him. In Christ I have the eternal life that the wicked rich vainly seek by their wealth. And I have so much more. And when Christ comes again on that blessed day, then will be the dawn of full victory for God's people. And the high and the low will be reversed. Verse 14, "The upright shall have dominion over them in the morning." In the morning, the dawn of that great day, all will be made right. And all will know God has redeemed my soul from the grave. God has received me and set me up in honor in His kingdom by grace alone, not because I did something that earned it, not because I gave Him something to get it, but because He, in mercy, came down and did for me what only He could do. Thanks be to Him. Amen.